You didn't on account of no West Texas boy ever leaves it for long. It gets in you like a tapeworm. You can't stay away even if you was wanted here for topping a nun. His theme had him so worked up he forgot to ask forgiveness from me or the Pope. He's here, count on it, and so's his crew. They rustled 1,000 head of Herefords outside Whitehorse just last week. Captain Jordan had said it was 500. Rumors seemed to grow faster in that arid soil than other places. But I wasn't supposed to know anything about the rustling, so I didn't correct him. His was the first statement I'd heard that corroborated Judge Blackthorne's conviction that the gang operated close to home. Did you tell the authorities the man was local?
I told everyone that bothered to listen, but it skidded off him like spit. Bad hats come from Missouri and Kansas and from down below the Rio Grande. Nobody wants to hear we're growing our own.
I doubted that was the reason. As far as I could tell, he'd spoken of this to Texans exclusively, who might be expected to regard one of their own as less than sensitive to differences in dialect. But shotgun messengers crossed state and territorial lines and guarded passengers from all over the country. They might not be connoisseurs of geographical speech patterns, but they would know domestic from imported. Why West? Don't all the natives of this state sound the same?
To you, maybe, but you're green. Much east of San Saba, they could pass for Virginia, though not to a Virginian like as not. I don't claim special powers, just good hearing.
What about the driver? Randy, was that his name? Didn't he back you up?
Randy's from Connecticut originally. He thinks everyone talks funny once you get past New Haven.
Does he live here in town?
His wife got spooked after the robbery and made him move to Louisiana and clerk in a freight office. You ask a lot of questions for a preaching man.
I could have played that two ways. Emphasize my willingness to bring comfort to the stricken, or fall back on Brother Bernard's past. I chose the one less holy.
I'm sorry to pry. This is the first time I've been more than 5 miles from where I was born. I'm overcome with the strangeness of it all. I never realized this country was so big.
He laughed then and helped himself to another biscuit. I'd scored with his provincial pride.
Oh, well, brother, if the panhandle's as big as you think it gets, wait till you take the train to El Paso. You can hide all of New England and most of Michigan between there and where we're sitting.
Other diners had begun to file in. The kitchen door opened and a woman nearly as thin as Sweet leaned in, wiping her hands on her apron. She stared at the back of his head until he turned her way, started, and rose.
Thanks for the palaver, brother. It saved me scrubbing pots.
I stood and shook his hand again. I can see you're both busy. I'd like to come by sometime and meet your sister.
You wouldn't like it long. She lumps in Protestants with pagans and Chinamen.
I took out my wallet, but he stopped me with a palm.
Put it in the poor box on me, he said. I'm not so certain as Janie. I like to back the other feller's hand just in case.
I thanked him and left. I was in the right place. I was sure of that now. I just didn't know what for. Chapter 16. The First Unitarian Church of Owen was filled nearly to capacity that first Sunday, but having made few contacts during my brief time in town, I put it down less to personal impression than to plain curiosity. A medicine show or a company of dwarves would have filled the place as efficiently. I'd committed a professional blunder early when Mrs. McIlvain hastened in at my first pull on the bell rope, flung down her broom, and seized the rope from my hands. No one had told me bell ringing was one of her duties, and from the alien serenity in her expression while she tugged away, I concluded it was her favorite. She said not a word to me the rest of the day, which, when you factored in how few she measured out all told, made for a profound silence.
Almost all the pews were filled when Richard and Colleen Freemason arrived and walked all the way up the aisle without stopping to a space in front that had been conspicuously left vacant. He wore a black morning coat with piped lapels over a gray double-breasted waistcoat and gray trousers without a crease to indicate that it had never spent time on a shelf with the ready-mades. She, an unadorned velour dress with her hair gathered beneath a tricorn hat angled slightly with a small feather. The dress looked black until she crossed through a sunbeam slanting in through a window, when it proved to be a very dark maroon. Freemason shook the odd hand, scarcely slowing his pace. Standing at the pulpit, I took mental note of the hands he didn't shake because they weren't offered, and the faces that went with them. They were stony as a rule and turned straight ahead as he passed. In this way, I managed to catalog those acquaintances connected with or sympathetic to the cattle trade. Colleen kept her gaze forward. I remembered what the clerk in the Wells Fargo office had said about her aloof reputation. That friendly fellow sat near the center of a pew halfway down, next to a woman close to his age, whose expression was as grim as those of Freemason's enemies. I'd seen that same look on many female faces over the years when Colleen was present. The women were always respectable in appearance and nearly always less attractive. When the couple was seated, Freemason with his banker's tile in his lap, I ventured a look from my notes and met Colleen's eyes, blue and cool and casually friendly, fully in keeping with the wife of a church director who wished the new pastor well on his first day. To this day, she remains the best poker player I ever met, and I've played with Luke Short and Arnold Rothstein. I broke contact to put my pages in order. I was as nervous as a cat. Everything Eldred Griffin had told me about when and where to pause, how often to look up, and where to look, fled from memory. Speaking in an empty church to a stern taskmaster of a tutor had been unsettling. Pretending wisdom of things spiritual before a packed house put bats in my stomach, and the certain knowledge that at least one of my listeners knew me for a fraud made my throat dry as Texas. I took too hearty a drink from the tumbler of water Mrs. McIlvaine had set out for me on the shelf beneath the lectern, and had to fight back an explosive cough, which I covered by clearing my throat noisily into a fist. This was worse than facing a pistol in a hostile hand, because I knew what to do if mine misfired. There was nothing to duck behind that would spare me from scorn and only ignominious retreat through the side door for escape. I thought of Judge Blackthorne in his pew in the Presbyterian Church in Helena, and wondered if he paused in his devotions to consider my situation and allow himself a smile with his cumbersome teeth. I was wearing the fine shirt Esther Griffin had stitched for me with her husband's cutthroat collar, and had spent the previous evening brushing my coat and trousers and blacking my town shoes, which pinched and made me yearn for my good broken-in boots, but which at least distracted my attention from the terror of the moment. With unsteady fingers, I opened my hymnal, as worn and grubby as any that had been placed in the racks, held it flat atop my notes, took a deep breath, and led the parishioners in a hymn. I've a strong voice, and had been told I could sing without embarrassing myself unduly, but I was grateful for the baritones in the gallery that drowned out the wobble. The hymn had a calming influence, as of course it was intended to. By the time the last stanza finished in the rafters, I felt a little less like bolting. Someone coughed in the silence. I took that as my downstroke and began my sermon. I'd moved the hymnal to the shelf beside the tumbler and brought up the Bible I'd carried from Montana Territory, opening it to the passage I'd marked with a strip I'd torn from the old newspaper lining the drawer in the parsonage. I wet my throat again, a small sip this time, and read. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, Whence comest thou? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, Doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made an hedge about him, and about his house, and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth thine hand now, and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he hath is in thy power, only upon himself put not forth thine hand. Hereupon I closed the book with as much reverberation as I could muster, wishing it were as substantial as the one in Griffin's study, which boomed like a rebel four-pounder when he slammed it shut. I was, however, aware of a sudden awakening in my audience. I'd been correct in my guessing that the succession of lay readers who'd been putting them to sleep with rote had not deigned to depart from the text, and from the reaction I made bold to ponder whether the Reverend Rose had been in the practice of delivering sermons from his own hand. What I did wasn't heresy, not yet, but I felt an edge of uncertainty in the air, heavily tinged as it was with furniture oil and Sunday suit mothballs, and uncertainty was something I knew a thing or two about. My friends, I said, you know this story. In his desperation to turn Job against God and prove his point, Satan rustled his sheep and oxen, dropped a house on his seven sons and three daughters, and afflicted him with boils. Job was no more than mortal, complaining bitterly of his losses and his miseries, which he professed he had done nothing to bring upon him. But he maintained his faith in his Lord, even when his wife counseled him to curse God and die. And so the Lord restored his chattel twofold, granted him seven new sons and three new daughters, and gave him twice his 70 in years as a reward for his unshakable faith, while Satan crept away beaten, with his forked tail tucked between his legs. To illustrate this image, which does not appear in the book of Job, I walked 2 fingers across the top of the pulpit, staggering a little. Amusement rippled through the crowd. I let it die down, then continued. Some would say that God was flattering himself when he declared that justice had been rendered unto his servant, that 7 new sons and 7 new daughters did not replace the lives of the 7 sons and 3 daughters, and that doubling the span of Job's days denied him reunion with those he had lost at the end of his 70. They're right, of course. That drew a gasp and a murmur, but I was concentrating on Colleen, who met my gaze with polite interest, nothing more. It was as if we hadn't discussed the subject only the day before yesterday. I said, One sheep looks pretty much like another, and an ox is just a steer broken to harness. Even Charles Goodnight would be hard-pressed to distinguish between 2 longhorns standing side by side. More chuckles. Goodnight had brought prosperity to the region when he established his ranch near Palo Duro Canyon and was a popular subject locally. Children are another matter. Nothing but the resurrection of Job's original sons and daughters would serve as adequate compensation for his sufferings. God knew this. He wept for Job's great loss, and rendered unto him the only justice available. For there can be but 1 mortal resurrection in the Holy Book, and that must be performed by his Son. I rearranged my pages, pretending to read them. I'd committed the text solidly to memory. I looked up and smiled. Owen has been kind to this pilgrim, cleansing him and giving him bread and protecting his small heap of belongings, refusing to accept anything in return. Nowhere have I seen greater evidence of faith in God. I'm told that before I came, this country had been afflicted with range wars and highwaymen, stricken by murderers and forsaken by those who were pledged to keep it from evil. Yet you welcomed a stranger, not with suspicion or malice, but with love. And so Satan has lost again, and must go to and fro in the earth in search of some other victim to prove his false theory. For the Book of Owen is a work still in progress. There was no applause, naturally, but when I called for another hymn, the house responded with energy, basses booming, sopranos trilling, and the inevitable tone-deaf howls enthusiastic. It wasn't exactly the equivalent of a standing ovation, but I had the impression I'd passed my first test. I added points by bringing the services to a close after reading the community announcements I'd been given and reciting the 41st Psalm. I took my place beside the door to the street as the parishioners filed out, shaking hands with the men and bowing to the women. My notices were mostly positive, although one red-faced fellow who'd slept through most of the morning, stirring just long enough to hear me refer to myself as a pilgrim, expressed the opinion that I should have withheld Plymouth Rock until Thanksgiving. An old woman in rusty weeds told me she wished her husband had lived to hear me speak, and spent 5 minutes cataloging his trials while others grew impatient and left the line behind her. Richard Freemason took my hand in his iron grip. Either he was accustomed to dealing with politicians or Captain Jordan had been mistaken when he'd called him a gentleman rancher. Poking letters into pigeonholes is poor exercise for the hands. "I felt I'd made a good choice in you when we met," he said. "It's a pleasure to have that feeling confirmed." "Thank you, sir. I had misgivings about the references to sheep and cattle." "Those wars are finished, and subtlety is lost on Texas. You should publish."
"I wouldn't presume."
"Nonsense. I have some acquaintances in publishing who may have some contacts with the ecclesiastical press. I'll give you a recommendation."
I thanked him and found his wife's gloved hand in mine.
"Wherever did you find your inspiration?"
Her smile carried no trace of mockery.
"I found it in a charming new acquaintance, Mrs. Freemason," I said. If she wanted to broach the subject in the presence of her husband, I wouldn't back away. "I came with a bundle of sermons, but none was appropriate to our discussion. I promised you a sermon in return for your gracious hospitality, you may remember." Freemason said,
"The story of Job is one of Colleen's bugbears. I'd no idea you two had dissected theology at the house."
"Brother Bernard is very approachable, dear. I won't say he's converted me to the God of the Old Testament, but he makes an excellent case for the defense. One might think he knew his way around the halls of justice."
She'd made a bargain not to expose me. Nothing had been said about torture. I put a smile on my face I hoped was modest. "My father was a deacon. One of his happiest entertainments was to engage me in religious discourse from the time I was old enough to read scripture."
"My father was a butcher in Manchester," Freemason said. "I can't recall a single intelligent conversation I ever had with him. Tell me, brother, with which church was your father affiliated?"
I'd made a mistake in volunteering a detail from Sebastian's manufactured past. Now I hesitated to provide specific information that could be exploded by a simple inquiry. Colleen, of all people, came to my rescue. She placed a hand on his arm.
"Dear, we mustn't monopolize the brother. Others are waiting to speak with him."
"Of course. Mrs. Freemason and I would be honored to have you in for dinner. Will you be free this afternoon?"
"I'm honored to accept." There was nothing for it but to open myself to further inquisition. Inventing an excuse wasn't an option. I've always found it difficult to tell a white lie while I was living a direct falsehood.
"Splendid. 2 o'clock.
Colleen's smile was angelic. That was when she was at her most diabolical. She gave me a nod and left on her husband's arm. By the time the church doors closed, I had 3 more invitations to dine that week.
Returning to the parsonage, I locked the door, opened my valise, took out the bottle of Old Forester I'd brought from Helena, and helped myself to a secular swig. Chapter 17. My mother was American, Richard Freemason said. Still is, I suspect, although we haven't spoken in 10 years. She's never forgiven me for deserting her for the frontier, but since she always cashes the bank drafts I send her in Boston, she hasn't wasted away from a broken heart. I'm a man, and therefore unworthy of her trust. I have my father to thank for that. He proposed to her in London while she was taking the grand tour with her parents, representing himself as the owner of a chain of meatpacking plants that exported abroad, but after a wedding trip to Brighton, she learned he had only the one shop, and his most distant customer lived 6 squares away. She divorced him when I was 5 and brought me with her back to the States. Evidently, having made one disastrous decision on the spur of the moment, she was determined to take her time, arriving at the second. And was that disastrous as well? I sat back to give Fiello, the venerable Mexican manservant, room to ladle chowder into my shallow china bowl. Ocean fish was an almost non-existent delicacy in West Texas. Eventually, but I had a hand in how it turned out. My grandparents furnished her with an annuity to help rear me until age 18. I leapt the fence at 15, and when they found out, they cut her off without a penny. She made me aware of that fact in her response to a letter I sent months later, bringing her up to date on my experiences since quitting the maternal nest. That was our last exchange. She's never sent me so much as an acknowledgement for the money I send regularly. Have done since I got my first job stocking shelves in a dry goods in St. Louis. Her bank takes care of that by providing the canceled drafts with her signature on the back. Still, I said, you have kept the fifth commandment. That speaks well of you. It speaks better of Colleen, who insisted I continue after I expressed the opinion that I had paid the old lady sufficient rent for the time I spent in her womb. Colleen shook her head when the old man arrived at her place with his tureen. He served Freemason and returned to the kitchen. As with bold entrepreneurs the world over, she said, odious rumors follow Richard everywhere he goes. The monthly emolument is a small price to pay to avoid accusations of abandoning his own mother. That was vanity and a sin, but I forbore to point it out. Griffin had drilled into me the importance of not preaching to one's hosts. Furthermore, it was a lie. Colleen had climbed to a precarious level where her past balanced delicately against her current claim to respectability. Whispers that she'd bewitched her husband into maintaining her in luxury while his mother starved would make her an expensive liability if he intended to increase his grip on the panhandle. If that was his aim, I hadn't gotten his measure yet. To an extent, her true motives exonerated her. The Bible says nothing against taking action in one's own defense. The dining room was small by the standards of that type of house, but seemed spacious by way of its lack of fussy detail. It contained none of the porcelain bric-a-brac and lace and velvet drapery that turned large eastern salons into crowded airless warehouses where you had to plan your entrances and exits beforehand to avoid knocking over some favorite piece of gimcrack. The rectory table was less than 10 feet long and stood on 4 handsomely turned legs atop a rug of old-world manufacture with both halves of the globe embroidered in its center, with 5 of the full set of shield-back chairs placed against the walls and a massive sideboard carved from fruit wood where additional courses could be placed to keep the serving apparatus operating smoothly during larger affairs than ours. Good landscapes hung in gilt frames, and a crystal chandelier built on the modest scale of the room were the only ornaments in sight. I sensed the hand of the lady of the house in the decoration. She would march resolutely in the opposite direction of the gold-etched mirrors, glistening mahogany, and dripping bronze barbarity of the saloons where she had made her living before she found an easier way. The food was excellent and in keeping with the room's quiet taste. After the chowder, we ate roasted breast of duckling in a light cream sauce, asparagus in butter, sweet potatoes, warm, moist bread, in my experience second only to Jane Sweet's biscuits at the Panhandle restaurant, and finished with mincemeat pie and coffee poured from an oriental silver decanter. The cook, Freemason said, had come from Belgium to open a tea room with her husband in New York City, only to lose him to fever during the voyage. The sheepman had discovered her slinging delicately seasoned stew in a bunkhouse full of ranch hands who wouldn't know fennel from feathergrass, and appropriated her to serve as his personal chef. The coffee was as good as Charlie Sweet's, refined probably with eggshells without recourse to the mythical properties so many amateur brewers assign to chicory. I was relaxed, but on my guard. That medicinal jolt of whiskey had flattened my nerves, and I had a story ready in case Freemason pressed the point of my fictional father's church, the fires that had plagued Denver until an ordinance was passed requiring all new construction to be made of brick had claimed any number of such institutions, an excuse I hoped would retard the process of confirmation long enough for me to finish my work in Owen. He didn't ask, however. He seemed more concerned with how much part the First Unitarian Church might play in the progress of civilization in the region. Primarily, he sought assurance that the railroad would come to town instead of bypassing it for Whitehorse or some other point, leaving Owen to dry up and blow away before the incessant wind from Arizona.
"Please don't be offended when I tell you there was resistance to appointing an evangelist to the pastorship," he said, stirring sugar into his cup. "Some members of the board of directors opposed the, rootlessness of your particular denomination. I reminded them that solid Unitarianism had done nothing to slow the erosion every time the Reverend Rose served up one of his tasteless homilies from Numbers. Surely there is no other book that so thoroughly replicates the effect of reading a shopkeeper's inventory." I smiled.
50,400 of the children of Naphtali, 603,550 of the children of Israel, 62,700 of the children of Dan. I confess that I could never satisfy myself as to the correct total of my mother's household accounts until I arrived at the same sum three times. I must own that my reason for trying to put life in my sermons is not entirely selflessness. It's important for a minister to set a good example by staying awake at the pulpit.
And so you did. And so did the congregation, mostly.
He'd been seated in front of the red-faced parishioner who'd snored his way through most of the service from the first hymn to the last amen.
"I dare say you bought me some credibility with the rest of the board this morning. The true test will come next Sunday, when we learn the amount of attrition now that native curiosity is satisfied."
"You may concern yourself with other things, Richard. Brother Bernard is no flash in the pan."
I looked at the lady of the house, sipping her coffee black from a cup so thin I could see the contrast between the contents and its surface. I wasn't looking for any sign of dissembling, because I knew they wouldn't show. After the journey through the bleak landscape of the Cimarron Strip and what lay south of it, I owed myself the pleasure of the sight. It was no wonder Freemason had disregarded the disadvantages of her life story in order to place her at the head of his table. Not precisely the head. The couple observed the egalitarian practice of sitting not at opposite ends of the refectory piece, but side by side in the middle, facing their guest. Butcher's son that he was, and whatever else he may have been, robber baron or murderer or festering thorn in Judge Blackthorne's thick hide, he had a gift for politics. That was as important a trait in a ranching pioneer as rough justice and vision.
"Other concerns, indeed," said he,
and when I turned my attention back to him, there was no indication on his face that the conversation had been light until then.
"The sheep wars are finished, barring the odd inevitable flare-up, but these bandits must be addressed. Railroad builders think nothing of blasting their way through miles of granite, but a series of disconnected raids can force them to change their course by 100 miles. I know you've heard about our late troubles in that area. You had breakfast yesterday with Charlie Sweet."
I was careful there. The palmists may have been right. Give a man or a thing a moment's thought in some company, and it's the same as saying the name aloud. I didn't see you there.
I wasn't. Madame Lemonnier's ducklings and pastries have spoiled me for the beans and bacon in the panhandle. It's a small town still, and that collar stands out. By now, half the population's convinced you've converted Sweeney from Roman idolatry, if not his formidable sister.
It was as much a question as a statement, and I took my time chewing and swallowing a mouthful of pie before I answered. I'd heard about the stagecoach robbery when I stopped in Wichita Falls. The clerk in the freight office here gave me more details. When I found out Mr. Sweet was the man serving me breakfast, I inquired about his health. I've learned that talking about such things brings comfort.
Taking action against them brings surcease. Sometimes I think the raids are not disconnected after all, and that these brigands have set themselves to drive me to ruin.
You're being melodramatic, Colleen said. You suffered direct losses in three of the raids, but not all. Considering the amount of business you do and how dependent it is upon the railroads, you make a broad target.
In a way, I'm connected to them all. When they hit their first train, they made off with my payroll. The second was carrying securities I'd borrowed from my bank in Chicago to repair the loss. The cattle they rustled at Whitehorse were purchased from Goodnight to trade in Colorado for breeding stock to improve my wool yield. I've suffered more than anyone from these raids, and if the railroad bypasses Owen because of them, I'll be a pauper. I confess, brother, to envying Job at one point during your sermon, my faith is not so stalwart.
I resisted reminding him that Sweet and the cowhand slain at Whitehorse may have suffered as much. If Job's convictions were less rare, I'd have no work.
Colleen said, you might chide him for the sin of pride. Not every misfortune takes place with him in mind.
I wouldn't presume. In his own house. I trust pains were taken to keep secret the details of how the valuables were being transported. Freemason's bulbous forehead gathered in bunches.
They were known to no one but my representatives, myself, and the people I do business with. Are you suggesting a Judas?
I'm unqualified to suggest it. I'm unschooled in the ways of the world and too curious for comfort. Please accept my apologies. He lifted his cup to his lips.
Sometimes innocent eyes see clearest. Lord knows my garden is crawling with serpents.
Colleen said, perhaps the brother suspects Eve. I made so bold as to intercept her gaze, but it lingered less than an instant before turning to her husband, who made a dry sound in his throat and patted her hand.
My dear, I'd sooner suspect the brother of an indiscretion.
He returned to his reflections.
If I find this serpent and sever its head, another will take its place. I've beseeched the governor to send us a company of rangers, but it appears I exhausted all my goodwill in Austin when he agreed to support the fence-cutting law.
He set down his cup for refilling by Fiello, who had appeared behind his left shoulder.
I admit I hadn't considered the possibility of a breach in my wall. That suggests a single enemy. I wonder of which one.
Colleen said,
find the breach and trace it to its source. But where to start?
Coffee, senor.
The old Mexican hovered over me with the decanter. Part 3. The Book of Judas. Chapter 18. Colleen reminded Freemason he had work waiting and insisted on seeing me to the door. He shook my hand and withdrew to his study as she looped her arm inside mine. It felt pleasant, even if the last time she'd done that was just before someone had tried yet again to kill me.
You came all this way to break up a gang of common bandits?
She spoke low. People who keep servants do, as a rule. I didn't say that.
You didn't have to. Richard is the second person in town you've spoken to about the robberies. You have no outside interests, Paige. You're quite dull when you come down to it.
We can't all be as inspirational as Brother Bernard.
I'm not your spy. I've more to gain by being loyal to my husband than by robbing him.
You said yourself he's gone bust.
I've seen busted from both sides. His kind has a different definition. When he hasn't 10 cents for a shave, he can raise $1 million on his reputation. There ought to be another word for that kind of busted.
There is. It's called running a bluff. All the more reason to hit him for the hard, cold cash he gets up that way.
I'm not like that anymore.
I laughed. I don't believe it. No one ever accused you of being dull.
I'm serious. You get awfully tired dealing from the bottom of the deck. You start to wonder if the suckers are right, and the game's more fun if you play it according to Hoyle.
You wouldn't know Hoyle if he bet his watch and chain against the pot. We reached the door. She looked up at me. Her eyes were as clear as flakes of sky. How they stayed that way when they were attached to Colleen Bauer's brain stumped me worse than the infinite.
I'd suspect you of personal motives if I thought you ever had human qualities, she said. Did I break your heart?
You as much as said I don't have one.
Someone broke mine long before we met. And you know something? You can still feel the pain in a leg after it's been cut off and buried.
What about the houseboy? He's old enough to start thinking about a pension.
Fiello belongs to an old aristocratic family wiped out by Juaristas in the Revolution. He fought for his country in the Mexican War only to lose everything, including a son, after Maximilian fell 20 years later. He came here with nothing but the rags on his back and a ferocious hatred for all bandidos. He wouldn't lift a finger to help out the Yankee variety. Anyway, he's frail, his duties aren't physically demanding, and Richard pays him nearly as much as his top hand on the ranch. I asked him to. I doubt the old fellow would take the risk.
I'd like to visit the ranch. Can you arrange it?
So it's the gang you're after?
Yes. Are you happy now that you got me to say it?
The word is relieved. I wanted to make sure you weren't acting as Blackthorne's avenging angel.
What happened between Freemason and the judge?
Ask the judge.
She opened the door and held it. What about the ranch?
Shall I say you're eager to bring the godless hands into the fold?
Tell him Brother Bernard wishes to know more of the world.
And if he responds that he wishes to know more of Brother Bernard?
He won't. I accepted this invitation to give his people time to search the parsonage. I hid my traveling bottle in the outhouse and left a letter from Bernard's sweet dead mother where they wouldn't have to look too hard to find it.
Her face drew taut over its very good bones. Only a deeply corrupt man would suspect such corruption of a man he'd met only twice.
Avenging angels don't get halos. The man who taught me my gospel made that clear. He hadn't trusted the job to someone clumsy from the bunkhouse. If I hadn't purposely left the drawer in the nightstand slightly ajar and done some other things to provide tells that someone had been through the place, I'd have thought no one had entered it from the time I left until the time I returned. Mrs. McIlvaine had Sunday afternoon off to do whatever it was she did when she stood her broom in its shallow closet in the church, so I was fairly certain she hadn't been in to clean. The counterfeit letter containing Sebastian's brief biography was where I'd placed it, folded under the brass lamp on the nightstand with his mother's tintype leaning against its base, but the lamp was turned slightly. That pointed to a literate intruder who'd taken down the information to report to his employer. It being Sunday, I was sure a communication would be going out to Denver by tomorrow's Overland, seeking to confirm the letter's sparse details. Blackthorne never confided the nature of his intelligence organization to subordinates. I had to assume that whoever had handled Sebastian's telegraph exchange with Freemason was in charge of such follow-ups, but I didn't trust him, or for that matter, anyone else who held my fate in his hands.
I had only the hope that the vague wording of the letter on the nightstand would slow down the inevitable long enough for me to get what I needed and make away. Since that involved pumping the judge for the details of his past relationship with Freemason, I propped myself up in the iron bed with a writing block on my knees and drafted the following message. Dear Mr. Smith, I've been in Owen days only, and everyone I've met has gone to great lengths to make me feel important. Although I confess to homesickness, it is, I'm convinced, God's will that I am in a place where I know my work is useful and wanted. Already I flatter myself that I have brought comfort to the afflicted. Mr. Freemason's confidence in my humble gifts is reassuring and gives me strength to believe that nothing I did in the past is a tenth part of the good that my service to the Lord will accomplish here. All that came before is prelude to the hard work and sleepless nights put to the purpose of bringing light to Texas. Please accept my sincere thanks for your kindness to a stranger. Yours in faith, Bernard Sebastian. I smudged up several sheets, counting words, striking some out and adding others, before I had a draft I could transcribe in proper penmanship and put aside to mail by way of the Overland to Mr. J. Smith, in care of General Delivery in Wichita Falls. Captain Jordan, who'd assured me there were upwards of 24 J. Smiths in town and among the ranches and settlements within plausible riding distance, had a standing agreement with the postmaster to hold all missives thus addressed for his scrutiny. Together, we'd worked out a code that would enable me to write what appeared to be a harmless communication to some random brief friendly acquaintance while putting the Texas Rangers to service to the federal court. It was a simple enough cipher, but with sufficient room provided for to drench it in homely verbiage. After the greeting, every 20th word conveyed the actual message. If it was urgent and assistance was required immediately and in force, I would begin with, "My dear Mr. Smith." Otherwise, I was asking Jordan to forward the actual text by Western Union to Blackthorne. I had written, "Important no Freemasons passed before Texas." After placing the letter in the nightstand drawer where I didn't care who found it if I happened to become separated from it, I got up and fed the scribbled sheets to the fire in the laundry stove. I'd taken all the precautions I could without feeling one bit more secure than I had before I'd written it. I don't place much trust in encryptions, on the theory that what one or two men could create, one or two others could dismantle. Carrier pigeons had at least the advantage of passing through no human hands between dispatch and delivery, but the thought that my life depended on a creature that spent most of its time from one mission to the next picking lice from its feathers was worse than knowing that the number of people who were in on my masquerade would fill out the regimental band at Fort Custer, with the last person I'd trust with either my wallet or my hide sharing a bed and who knew how many secrets with the man whose measure I was trying to take. It was enough to drive a God-fearing man to drink. I was weighing the relative risk of retrieving the whiskey bottle from the outhouse when someone knocked on the door of the parsonage. I reached for my collar, then decided to leave it off, and went through the sitting room with my sleeves rolled up and a towel from the dishpan wash basin over my arm, the Dean Adams concealed inside its folds. At first glance, I thought the man on my front step was Freemason, but then I saw the frock coat was too large for the visitor's slight frame, and the silk hat rested too low on his forehead, bending down his ears, and knew him for Fiello, the aged houseboy, wearing his master's cast-off. He removed the hat, cradling it with a forearm, and held out an envelope with the Masonic compass and square embossed on the flap. I laid the towel with the revolver rolled inside it on the rocking chair and took the envelope. The note was an invitation from Richard Freemason to accompany him to his ranch Tuesday at dawn. I asked the old man to take my acceptance to him with thanks. He bowed, turned, replaced the hat, and applied himself to the long walk back down the street and the steep climb up the limestone steps to the castle on the hill. He wasn't as frail as Colleen made out. Chapter 19.
Unexpectedly, I found my suspicions confirmed, or at least supported, the next morning, when the door to the freight office opened away from my hand and I was face to face once again with Fiello, who hesitated, raised and lowered his hand-me-down silk hat, and stepped past me onto the boardwalk. There were any number of reasons why the manservant of a busy ranch owner would have business with a stagecoach line, but I was satisfied that he'd just posted a letter to Denver on Freemason's behalf to test Brother Bernard's story. It was Monday, and a coach stood ready before the door. That meant a waiting line inside, and I joined it. Luther Cherry, looking every bit the scarecrow I'd met during the trip from Wichita Falls, in a morning coat plastered with lint and stray hairs, stood at the head of the line, arguing with the friendly clerk behind the counter.
$4.50 just to carry a letter to St. Louis? I might as well pay a little more and deliver it in person.
I'm sorry, sir, that's the special delivery rate. Undoubtedly, it will come down after they string a telegraph line from Wichita Falls. It always does. Competition, you understand. But that won't happen until after the railroad comes through.
Until which time, Wells Fargo will behave as arrogantly as any of the Eastern Trusts. My God, I could buy a decent suit of clothes and pocket 50 cents.
Clearly, this invited a suggestion, but being affable by nature, the clerk made another. Regular delivery is $2 if you don't mind it taking an extra day or so.
That won't do.
Muttering to himself, the lawyer produced 4 banknotes from a lank wallet and laid them on the counter, then snapped open a Scotchman's coin purse and placed a 25-cent piece, 2 dimes, and a nickel on top of them. The man behind the counter transferred them to a cash box, stamped a postmark on a long envelope in front of him, and poked it into a pigeonhole at his elbow. On his way to the door, Cherry, grumbling still, nearly passed me without looking up.
Life in the wilderness is not as reasonably priced as it was centuries ago, Mr. Cherry, I said.
Indeed it is not, friend.
He recognized me then and halted.
Good morning, brother. I worked late Saturday night and overslept the next day, missing your sermon. I heard it brought down the house.
Hardly that, but the reception was most kind.
I'm sorry you overheard that altercation. I miss my wife. But if I continue to communicate with her at these rates, I won't be able to afford her fare.
He glanced down at the envelope in my hand.
I hope your people are patient. The Overland is no place for a man sworn to poverty.
Fortunately, I made a new friend in Wichita Falls. The collection plate won't suffer mortally. He was only half listening, preoccupied with the hands of his nicked watch. Presently, he apologized for the demands of his workload, said goodbye, and took his leave. When my turn came, I handed the clerk my letter to Mr. J. Smith and paid its freight from the loose change in my pocket. He bent my ear over the excellence of the Sunday services until the people behind me began to clear their throats and shuffle their feet. A man tipped his hat, and a woman dipped her chin as I walked past. I touched my brim to both. I understood then a little about the seductive nature of the call. Edwin Booth was no more celebrated a figure on the streets of Chicago and San Francisco than a minister in a desert settlement. Dawn comes early in Flat Country. I'd just entered the church Tuesday carrying my 2nd cup of cowboy coffee, paint stirrer required, when the creak of a harness drew me to the door. A Brewster Green Stanhope stood on red wheels beside the boardwalk, hitched to a round-bottomed sorrel with the shoulders of a Percheron, and good job, because it was pulling 2 passengers already. Freemason, in a duster and flat-brimmed Stetson, sat holding the lines behind Luther Cherry. Today the sad-faced lawyer wore a straw hat and sturdy tweeds, out at the elbows, but a happier union than his town coat. He clutched a battered leather briefcase on his lap and held down his flapping hat with his other hand against a mild 40-mile-an-hour wind. As I climbed aboard, he pressed in close to the driver to make room on a seat properly built for 2. "Another good morning to you, brother," he said. "I apologize for the close quarters." I had a question about the boundaries, and Mr. Freemason was gracious enough to invite me to the ranch to see them for myself. No doubt you're growing tired of me by now. He was a drab companion, and I've never warmed to skinflints, but I protested the opposite. Surreptitiously, I wedged my arm between us to keep him from pressing against the revolver in its scabbard. I didn't want to take the chance of Mrs. McIlvain finding it in the parsonage, and in any case I wasn't about to venture into open country unarmed. Freemason measured out a smile of contrition. "I yielded to an impulse. The cabriolet is at the ranch, and all the two-seaters are out on hire from the livery. I had this rig built to my order, so it's sound, and Bess is accustomed to hauling furniture in tandem. But by the time we cross the river, I fear we'll be on rather more intimate terms with one another than we bargained for." I said, "I don't mind. Mr. Cherry's presence shortened my journey here." "A fine piece of fortune," said the sheepman. "I engaged both of you sight unseen on the strength of my judge of character. Cherry clerked in the St. Louis firm that handled most of my transactions. When he passed the bar with applied study in real property, I retained him immediately. The man's knowledge is worth 10 miles of fence." The lawyer laughed. "If I may speak for Brother Bernard as well as for myself, it's handy there's just the one seat. You might otherwise have been tempted to bring along our friend the wire drummer and expose us all to an exhaustive lecture on the relative merits of Glidden versus Reynolds and whether Sunderland's kink is as effective a deterrent as the Brink twist." "I've had my life's portion of those fellows." Our host released the brake and gave the lines a flip. Bess rolled her haunches and we were in motion. "They make no distinction between the walrus hide of a bull and the tender membrane of a ewe. Great patches of scar tissue are as devastating to the harvest of wool as blight to corn. Barbs are designed to contain cattle, dumb brutes that wander away from shore feed to graze on dead thistle in the desert. A week-old lamb knows better than that. No doubt Bo Peep abused her flock." No hint of a smile cracked his countenance. I changed hands on my hat and shouted across the wind, "If you don't mind my asking, why then did you lobby so hard to strengthen the fence-cutting law?" "Not to keep sheep in, you can be sure of that. I fought for it in order to keep the damn cattlemen out." At length we crossed Wild Horse Creek at a point where deep ruts left by other vehicles marked the ford. The waters had just begun to recede from the spring runoff and lapped at our hubs. When we rolled up the bank on the other side, the big mare shrugged, sprinkling us all. "A second baptism," offered Cherry. For a mile or so, we rode alongside 4 strands of wire strung between crazy crooked scrubwood posts that any rancher in good timberland would have scorned in favor of straight pine or cedar, while the tough short stubble of buffalo grass gradually gave ground to a lush expanse of bluestem nearly 3 feet high, ideal for grazing. Freemason had chosen his location well. The relentless wind combed the tops in hypnotic waves like the pattern on the surface of an inland ocean. I directed my gaze away from it toward the level horizon to keep from becoming drunk on the sight. The grasses of the high plains are proof that you can get seasick on dry land. I spotted the horse and man in the road first, just ahead of the rancher who stiffened at the sight. The man was out of the saddle and kneeling near the fence in the attitude of cutting the wire. Freemason leaned forward and drew a brass receiver Winchester from the footboards at the base of the seat onto his lap. This alerted Cherry. "What a place to come bang up," he said. "It's lucky for him we happened along." Trust a lawyer to size up a situation at one glance. I could see then that the man was too far from the fence to threaten it. At first I thought his horse had thrown a shoe, but as we drew near I saw that the man down on one knee with his back turned toward us was scraping at its right forefoot with a knife,
paring the hoof or prying at a stone or some other object that had gotten wedged inside the iron. Our host relaxed, loosening his grip on the pistol stock of the repeater.
"Need help, friend?" he called out.
The man spun on his knee without rising, cocking and leveling a long-barreled Colt at Freemason across the crook of his right arm. He wore a gray hat, range flannels, and a blue bandana that covered the lower half of his face. My reflexes were a split second faster than the rancher's. My hand made an entirely involuntary move toward the revolver under my coat, but I stopped it through sheer force of will before it had covered a half inch. The masked man was concentrating on Freemason, who snatched at the carbine across his lap. The Colt flamed, and something struck a post holding up the Stanhope's canvas roof. Freemason abandoned the Winchester to seize the lines and calm Bess. The report seemed to serve double duty as a signal. From the fence and road, the grass-covered ground sloped gently toward the river, forming a shaggy apron some 30 feet wide between hardpack and water. In one smooth motion, a handful of horses scrambled to their feet, seeming to rise from the earth itself as if on hinges, and levitating riders into their saddles. I was more impressed than frightened. It takes more than just good horsemanship to keep 800 pounds of nervous animal on its side without snorting or tossing a head or a tail. Two hands are hardly enough to keep it calm and its nostrils covered, and man and horse hidden in grass not much more than knee-high, and simple athletic ability alone won't let him rise with it, slipping one foot into the stirrup and swinging the other leg over its back in the same movement, man and beast uniting as one. It was like something out of Revelation. The first beast was like a lion, and the second beast like a calf, and the third beast had a face as a man, and the fourth beast was like a flying eagle. And the four beasts had each of them 6 wings about him, and they were full of eyes within. Only there were 5 beasts, clad in pale dusters, gray hats, and blue bandanas, and when the man in the road swung aboard his horse, the muzzle of his revolver remaining on point like the needle of a compass, we faced 6 armed men, the others kneeing their mounts forward until they formed a half circle about us with weapons in hand. A sharp double clack rang out across the wind, and I turned my head as a 7th rider cantered our way from Freemason's property on the other side of the fence with a fresh round levered into a Spencer rifle. He wore the uniform of the pack, a strip of tanned and weathered face showing between the top of his bandana and the brim of his hat. "What does the good book say about 7 angels? Cherry asked me in a low voice. "These aren't angels." 10 yards from the fence, the newcomer shouted and smacked his reins across his horse's withers, breaking it into gallop. It closed the distance in seconds and left the earth with no more apparent effort than a balloon rising, clearing the top strand of wire with inches to spare and breaking to a halt short of the road, 4 legs stiff and its rider leaning back on the reins, the repeater cradled along his right forearm. Cherry did a foolish thing. Startled by the feat of athletic horsemanship and the thud of the landing, he shifted on the seat and his briefcase slid from his lap. He lunged to catch it. The Spencer bellowed, and there was one less lawyer in Texas. Chapter 20. Something hot and wet splashed the back of my left hand. It was Luther Cherry's blood as he arched his back upon impact, then sagged against me with all his weight. He was breathing, but the nasty sucking sound meant a shot lung and a short life. For me, there was no harnessing my instincts. Bess tried to rear between the traces, occupying both of Freemason's hands and all of his concentration. The Dean Adams was in my right hand, pointed at the man with the Spencer before I could give any thought to the action. 6 hammers and the lever of the repeater crackled across the wind. Facing 7 muzzles, I let the revolver fall to the floorboards and raised my palms to my shoulders. I was conscious of Freemason's eyes on me, leveled across Cherry's bent frame. For 5 minutes, It was more likely seconds. Only the wind stirred. Then the man with the Spencer jerked his head at the rider nearest me, who nudged his mount alongside the buggy, leaned over to slide the Winchester off Freemason's lap, and tossed it to another rider nearby, who caught it one-handed. He scooped up the Dean Adams and examined it, then flipped it toward the man with the Spencer. The Helena baseball team could have used that bunch in the infield.
"Check out the satchel."
The lawyer's briefcase was opened and its contents dumped out. Papers fluttered in every direction like bats flushed from a cave. The rider shook his head and dropped it in the road.
"Nice iron for a plug hat preacher."
The man with the Spencer raised my weapon and sighted down the barrel at a point between my eyes. His voice carried above the wind with the ease of someone accustomed to raising it, with a West Texas accent as flat as the panhandle. I was convinced he was the man Charlie Sweet had heard giving the orders during the Overland robbery.
"Too good anyway for potting snakes and such." "He's right-handy with it, too."
The man who'd picked it up had marbles in his mouth, or, more practically, a cud in his cheek. I said nothing. I could feel the muzzle on me as if it were pressing against the bridge of my nose. At length, the Spencer man lowered it, shook the shells out of the cylinder, and flipped the revolver back my way.